if you want a pretty quick way to get your neuroses to trot out into the open, this creative activity is a pretty good one.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. I always struggle a bit with that opener because my natural inclination is to say hiya, but it just doesn't feel appropriate for a podcast intro. So anyway, the voice you heard there was that of George Saunders, who is the author of 11 books, perhaps most famously Lincoln in the Bardo, which won the 2017 Man Booker Prize. Mainly though, he's spent his career writing short stories. His stories have appeared regularly in The New Yorker since 1992, and he's published several collections of them. George was born in Texas, but he spoke to me from his house in upstate New York in December. The way I pictured it, I'm not sure if this is 100% accurate, was that he was in a cabin in the woods. And I know that he was connecting to our call via a hotspot on his phone because the Wi-Fi wasn't up to it. So we did have a few technical hitches, but I think the resulting conversation is still pretty great. George has for almost 25 years been teaching creative writing at the University of Syracuse. And I think that's pretty evident when you hear the way he talks about writing. He is clearly a very good teacher. His new book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, draws on some of that experience and looks at 7 classic Russian short stories. The format of the book is that the story is reproduced, or a translation of the story, and then there's a sort of essay by George which looks at how that story works, what the writer is doing, and why it gives us the feelings that it does. Or, you know, and also at certain points, things that aren't successful he looks at as well. So I found it really, really illuminating, and it made me feel a lot more interested in Russian literature than I had been previously. So thank you, George, for that. He has some really inspiring and thought-provoking things to say in this episode about how to get out of your own way as a writer, about how to develop your unique voice, and why he believes that when you hit a wall in a story, it's a sign that you're onto something good. Before we get started, I'm happy to say that this week's episode is sponsored by Curtis Brown Creative, the creative writing school affiliated to a major literary agency. Curtis Brown Creative offer a wide range of online courses to help you on your writing journey, including courses on novel writing, short stories, memoir, writing for TV, and writing for children. Their tutors include best-selling authors such as Kathy Rentzen Brink, S.J. Paris, and Erin Kelly. Over 120 of their former students have gone on to get book deals, including bestsellers Jane Harper, Jessie Burton, Claire Pooley, and Nicholas Searle. Their popular 6-week How to Write Your Novel courses are designed to take you all the way from first idea to final draft. Choose between starting to write your novel, write to the end of your novel, and edit and pitch your novel. The next round of these courses starts on the 11th of March, and you can enrol now. Curtis Brown Creative have provided an exclusive discount for listeners of In Writing, so you can use the code INWRITING20, that's INWRITING20, the digits, for £20 off one of their 4, 6 or 10-week online courses. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. And now, over to George Saunders. So I know you're not at home at the moment, is that right? Or you're in a second home, or where are you?
Right. We lived in upstate New York for many years, and then we moved to California, and now through a series of wild events, we're back in the house in New York where I wrote Lincoln and the Bardo, and up near Oneonta, New York.
And are you in the room where you would write?
I am now. I have a writing shed that's outside the house, but my daughter is using it now. So I'm in a kind of a front porch, and I'm working on stories in here now. So I have worked here in the past. So yes.
And so what would you describe it for me a little bit and paint a picture of where you sit and write?
It's kind of not a screened in porch, but a windowed in porch separate from the house, or, you know, on one side of the house. And it's really pretty. It overlooks some woods. We have some acre woods up here. There's a little snow on the ground. So it's super cozy. And, you know, we're just going to kind of weather the pandemic here, the three of us and 3 dogs and a diabetic cat. And so it's really sweet. It's also connected to the kitchen, which I really like. And when our kids were little, and, you know, we lived in a small house, and I kind of love that feeling of writing right in the middle of the family activities, and this is kind of awakening a lot of those feelings. Oh, it's so, I can just walk right over there and, you know, have a little conversation and coffee and then come back in and start again. So I'm really liking it.
Yeah. Do you like having the kind of background noise of family life while you're
working? I do. Yeah. It just makes me, it's interesting that the things that writing depends on are so complicated and almost inarticulable. But like I noticed that coming back here to New York, something about being in this environment has made a part of my brain kind of come alive again. And the same thing with writing in the family, it makes me feel, I talked to the writer Linda Berry one time, and she said she'd read a study that said that artists, in their artistic practices, they emulate the habits of play that they enacted when they were little kids. So if you were somebody who was given vast amounts of time to run freely, you might feel more comfortable working for hours at a time. If you were someone whose parents used to check up on you periodically, you might actually self-interrupt. So somehow being in a busy family setting, it works for me because I can kind of like, the Catholic part of me that doesn't feel comfortable doing well for very long, you know, gets kind of a chance to say, okay, you did well for 7 minutes. Now the cat just threw up. So go out there and earn another 7 minutes of decent writing, you know, like that.
So, are you working on anything at the moment, writing wise?
I literally just was working on a story before we got in touch. I just finished that book about the Russian short story, a big nonfiction thing, and during that I've been kind of tinkering with stories, and now I'm like full bore on trying to finish another book of stories. So that's just got one story that I'm almost done with, and two waiting in the wings, and that's the whole focus. It's just a short story.
Yeah, and so how do you, when you are working on something, what's your kind of pattern, or you know, at what time of day are you sitting down to work? And tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, ideally now it's, you know, we have all these pets, so I get up in the morning and I do sort of a variety of pet chores. And then once that feels like everybody in the house is sort of settled, then I come in here and work. And in a perfect day, it would be, you know, from maybe 8:30 or 9 till 4. But the way I really measure it is I have this editing process where I'm just, you know, 90% of the time I'm just editing a paper manuscript with a pencil, like micro editing it. So I'll get through one pass of the story in progress. Then there's a kind of a ritual thing where I go get a cup of coffee and then I input those changes, print out a fresh copy. And if I can do that like 3 or 4 times a day, that's a great day. And then by the fourth or fifth time, you know how you start to get a little blurry and you start making mistakes that you'll have to clean up the next day. So it's kind of like I'm kind of always watching that clarity of vision of my own story. And if the clarity maintains, I keep going. If it starts to fade, then I just, you know, wait. So that's the ideal. But then my first book I wrote at work. And so one of the things I've nurtured over the years is I can pretty much sit down, you know, if I see a 40 minute block, I'll just kind of throw a little switch in my head and say, okay, it's time to be serious, sit down, or time to be funny, whatever, sit down and work for that short interval, which that's something I learned when I was working at a company. So one thing I try to do is never discard a day. Like if the morning starts off in a crazy way and I don't get to my desk in time, I think when I was younger, I'd say, oh God, the world hates art. You know, I just stop up. And now I'm like, well, okay. But you know, if you can get, you know, over the course of a life, if you can salvage a 20-minute interval every week, that really adds up, you know? So I try to be a little bit gentle with myself in that way.
That's really good. So it doesn't, you can hit the ground running if you just have 20 minutes. You don't feel that you're, you know, I don't know, sharpening your pencil for 5 minutes and then, you know, that's productive time for you.
I guess I sort of say to myself, well, it might be, you know, and I, you know, from teaching all these years, I've noticed that when a writer is above a certain level, a lot of it is what I've heard described as the talent for having talent. So it has a lot to do with the way you allow or don't allow yourself to make progress. You know, those sort of obstacles you put in front of yourself kind of more neurotically than anything else, you know. So I tell my students, we have one of the skills we have to learn is to self-game a little bit, like to say, well, there's this writer named Hattie, and she has these habits, you know, and these are the good ones, and these are the ones that are obstructing. And this person named Hattie could say, you know, writer Hattie, if we just lightened up our, you know, the idea that we had to have pancakes before we wrote every morning, then suddenly you would have more writing days, you know. So it's an interesting thing where it kind of morphs over into self-help or psychology or something, because each person has some extant level of self-obstruction. And writing is a place where we really get to see that, right, stare that right in the face, you know. I have so many talented students who, just in terms of their writing ability, they're off the charts. And then they get into that kind of rarefied air of an MFA program, and something in them won't allow them to go forward. Mm-hmm. So, you know, or conversely, somebody who just has a pretty good talent, but has an amazing talent for having their particular talent, and their psychology allows them to go forward almost faster than you want them to, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's where I think teaching writing is interesting. Writing is interesting because if you want a pretty quick way to get your neuroses to trot out into the open, this creative activity is a pretty good one.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Yeah. When do you first remember writing?
Well, I can remember writing these really crazy xenophobic war stories when I was a little fourth or fifth grader. And it was, I think I was reading a lot of war books or something. So these stories always occasioned a boy like me finding a time travel machine and going back to 1942, you know, and then killing a bunch of people. But I didn't really think it was, writing was very interesting or cool until I got to high school. And we had there was a high school teacher named Sherry Lindblom, who was then Sherry Williams, but she taught a class in American Lit, and she just had such a wonderful way of talking about writers as if they were people, and as if they were people who, for whatever reason, were in a particular relation to their time. So they were sort of like interpreters of their era. And she, you know, you could tell she admired them and she liked them. And so a lot of the tone, the way she teaches is the way that I teach now, to say, you know, this is not supposed to be scary or intimidating. It's actually kind of fun. You do have the capability to be a good reader. Let's play with this a little bit, you know. So that was, I think, where I first, partly because she was really beautiful and I had a crush on her, and I thought, oh, if I could be like Nathaniel Hawthorne, you know. but you know, the idea that it was actually kind of a powerful thing to interpret experience. So that was maybe, you know, it was maybe 15 or something like that. And then, so for me, it was sort of like, now it looks like, of course, I always wanted to be a writer. But when I look back, I was kind of a working class kid who, you know, hadn't seen that model before, hadn't seen an artistic life model before. So it took me a number of years to kind of fully confess to it and embrace it.
Yeah. And am I right in thinking that you at one stage were doing quite kind of technical writing in the engineering industry? Have I got that right?
That's right. Yeah, I was trained as an engineer. I went to a place called the Colorado School of Mines, which people sometimes mishear and mime, you know, that we majored in walking against the wind. But then I got a job in Asia. So I went to work in Sumatra in the oil fields, and was what they call a field geophysicist. And then, long story, but came home, and then we started having our family, and I kind of cashed that degree and was a tech writer for an environmental company for about, I guess, 7 years while I was writing that first book. So I wrote it mostly at work.
So what made you start writing a book when you were kind of involved in this other world professionally?
Well, I think, you know, by the end of college, I realized that I was only, I was not a very good engineer. I had to really work hard just to be sub-average. But I was sneaking over to the library in college and reading mostly kind of modernist writers, Hemingway and, you know, Steinbeck. And I, you know, an idiot like I was could notice that when I was reading, my energy increased. You know, I started dreaming more and I was happier and kind of my focus. When I looked ahead at the rest of my life, I could see adventure in it and stuff like that. So I think by the time I went to Asia, that was kind of my back pocket idea, was I'm going to Asia to get these crazy experiences that I'll later, you know, put into a book. So I think even then I knew, but I wasn't a very well person at that point. I'd read kind of sporadically. And so there was kind of a, between that and the earlier mentioned neuroses, I was a person who was very afraid to try, since trying meant I could fail. You know, and I was afraid that if I had this cherished dream, the only thing I really wanted to do was be a writer by the time I was in Asia. And I was afraid that if I tried too hard and failed, then that door would shut. So there was a kind of a weird delay in my progress because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a high functioning person in the sense that, you know, a high functioning person would say, so I want to be a writer. I guess I should read a lot of stuff. And I should go where there are other writers, you know? And I was like, yeah, if I go where there are other writers, I might find out that I'm not one.
Yeah.
And if I read too much, I might find out that I can't do it. So it, there was a kind of a pretty long period where I played at being a writer. I liked the idea of having written something, but it wasn't actually doing much of it. And then finally, when I, you know, again, compressing a lot of stuff, I came home from Asia and kind of hit bottom in a certain, you know, kind of a light way. And I had an experience in Asia where I kind of was about to go into Afghanistan. I'd gotten these Mujahideen to agree to take me in. And at the 11th hour, I had this kind of like dark night of the soul where I thought, you know, why? I mean, actually, I was thinking about my mother and what she would think if I got killed in Afghanistan. And I just thought, why? What are you doing? And some older, like wiser part of myself said, well, I want to be a writer. And or I said that. And the wiser part said, are you writing very much? I'm like, well, no. They're like, well, why are you going to a war that you know that's dangerous when you haven't even done the basic baby work of sculpting your prose at all? You know, so somehow that part of myself rose to that. Went, yeah, that's a good point. Okay, you know, Hemingway was a great writer not because he was in World War One, but because he was a great prose stylist. You know, so then after that it was sort of a more serious, you know, endeavor, and I started reading more and actually putting in the hours a little bit.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It reminds me of, have you read The Artist's Way?
I have not.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to, clearly, but but it is a wonderful book, and there is a section in that where she talks about fear, and she says list all of the things that you're frightened of in relation to doing, you know, whatever it is that you want to do but are not doing. And I remember coming to that section and just writing down like 40 fears, you know, just things that I had never articulated. But I think, yeah, a big part of it for a lot of people is like, I don't want to even try in case it turns out that I am terrible at this. And then I've humiliated myself.
And you know, the thing is that the fear, I found it continues to be such a good friend to us because it's actually an aesthetic guide. You know, when you start a book, any book, one, you should be afraid that you're going to fail, afraid that you're going to bore the reader. But then once the story starts, it will present built-in difficulties that really the whole purpose of the book will be understood by the reader for you to overcome those difficulties. So I wrote this book about Lincoln. That's a big difficulty, to write a book with Lincoln in it. That's like, you know, the novel about Jesus, you know. So then I think when I was younger, I would have said, oh, that's too hard. I can't do it. I might screw it up. But with a little experience, you say, oh, the thing you're afraid of is actually going to be the thing that you convert into a virtue. You know, if you're afraid that your story is boring, then the kind of the 101 answer is don't make it so boring. You know, and it sounds a little facile, but I think that's that I always love that moment when I go, oh my God, this story is going to be a disaster if I, and then a little voice goes, well, don't do that. How else can you succeed unless there's a high risk of failure, you know? And the high risk of failure is also felt by the reader, I think, you know?
Yeah.
When Manuel Puig has Kiss of the Spider Woman and we see that it's going to be all in dialogue, we're like, I don't know about that. And he goes, well, let me prove it to you. You know, let me show you that this is a good move. So I think that's, for me, that was a turning point when I said, anytime you're in the middle of a work of art and it starts to resist you, that's great.
Yeah.
Because the resistance is a sign of independence and power. And then your job is to sort of work with it, not overpower it, but work with it to make that apparent problem a virtue.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about short stories in particular, because although you are an award-winning novelist, it seems as though you've spent maybe the largest part of your time as a writer working on short stories. Is that fair to say?
100%. Yeah. And I don't even know that that novel was a novel. It was something. But yeah, stories are my first and eternal love for sure.
So what is it about the form that works for you?
I think, well, one thing is I'm kind of neurotic in my worldview. And when I think about trying to write a novel that encapsulates my worldview, I just get panicked. I don't know. I don't know what I believe. And in fact, bearing down on that, what I really believe is in a billion multiplicities, you know, that the world is not any one thing. It's completely made by viewpoint. So, and so in terms of prose, that means I delight in the fact that I have infinite number of voices to use. A story can have a certain idea of the world built into its prose that I then abandon for the next story. So I guess I like the idea that you get an infinite number of shots at it. You know, these artistic shots at it don't take 12 years. They might take a couple years. But so I think the basic idea of a story collection is in line with my view of the world. You know, if I go into town here, there's not just one overarching third-person omniscient story going on. There's, you know, 20,000 separate jangled ones, and if we could hear them, they would all be in very distinct and strange languages with crazy viewpoints. So that's part of it. And then also, I think just, I guess in terms of my background, you know, the early aesthetic models I had that really captivated me were short sketch comedy pieces, especially like Monty Python, rock songs, and jokes. So those three things all have the same kind of half-life as a story, which is, again, according to Linda Barry, you get to the end of a story, and she said that these psychological studies have indicated that your mind does a spontaneous, involuntary retro-telling of the story in which it evaluates it for efficiency. So, you know, when you get to the end of the joke, if there was a 15-page digression about the duck who walked into the bar, that makes you laugh less. So I think for somebody who was sort of coming into literature as a poor reader, kind of late, the idea of a story as a very efficient little machine was something that I could work with. You know, the novel, I just don't even know what it is. It's so big, I have no theory. But the story, it's like, yeah, it's basically a joke with a little more heart, you know?
Yeah. And in your new book, you've taken seven short stories by Russian writers and you've sort of unpacked the effects of each one and what they might have been doing and why it works or doesn't. And I loved it. I thought it was, and I have to say that you really sold me on Russian literature, which I was not particularly interested in before. But you have such a sort of...
You're welcome, Tolstoy.
Yeah, I'm sure he's thrilled wherever he is. Yeah, you have such a sort of... this is an awful word, but accessible way of getting into that work, which I really appreciated. And also it's very funny. I want to talk about a few. I was turning over pages constantly because there were so many interesting things in there. And I want to talk about a few of them with you. There's a section where you talk about voice, you know, the author's voice, and you write about how you hoped initially to be a kind of Ernest Hemingway type writer. And then at some point you realised that actually your strengths lay elsewhere. And I thought that was so interesting because I think for so many aspiring writers, you can have these moments of like, I don't know, like, I would love to be Zadie Smith. I'm not Zadie Smith. I am never going to be able to write like her. So like, what is the point in me even writing anything? You know, you can have that feeling. And it's quite comforting to hear that sometimes you just have to kind of lean into the thing that you are good at. Would you talk a little bit about your experience of that?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say that that's a good thing to feel that way. Like if you have, first, everybody should want to be like Zadie Smith. But if you have that feeling, it means that you love writing. You love good writing, and you have, you've established part of your lineage, and that lineage includes Zadie. So that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's, I don't know a good writer who hasn't been in that position of admiring someone so much that you just want to become that person. That's just a sign of love for the form. So then what I write about in the book is that there's a bittersweet moment where you realize that if you set about being Zadie or being anybody, you know, anyway, or Faulkner, Toni Morrison, whoever, then you can only kind of be an assistant. You know, you're never going to be more Zadie than Zadie. That's almost like, you know, a given. So, and then furthermore, there's a moment that can happen where you realize that that particular voice, whoever your hero is, that voice can't get into the space about which you know something unique. You know, so for your life, you know, even if you're 22 or 20, your life has given you certain gifts and certain hardships and certain insights that are not describable in anybody else's mode. So there's a kind of a sweet but unsweet moment when you go, okay, in my case, I know some things about class and I know some things about work. And I didn't really plan to talk about those things in my writing. I was going to talk about trout fishing and being incredibly handsome, you know, whatever. Well, so then you think, well, but I noticed that my prose lights up when I write about class. Or when I write in a certain mode or when I feel a certain way when I write. If the prose lights up, the game is over. You have to go in that direction. So it's disappointing because you're leaving Zadie behind. You have to, or Hemingway or whoever. But it's also thrilling because you'll, for the first time, in my case, I saw a trace of myself on the page, and I saw a trace of something that was somewhat new. So it's not, you know, the victorious Rocky moment where you say, I found my, mom, I found my voice. You know, it's much more like, mom, I found my voice. So that's beautiful, you know, that kind of defeat slash victory that we get into. And then the next turn of the mind is to say, okay, this first, you know, indication that I have some originality is pretty pathetic. But if I just keep sort of gnawing at it, maybe in time it will grow into something that's actually substantial, you know. I think that's just the way it goes. And I see with my students, they come in and some of them are very adept impersonators of other writers. And the game there is to try to say, yeah, you know, you can certainly imitate David Foster Wallace if you like. And the job then is to kind of through line edits, actually, and hopefully very gently, show this person that their imitation of David is not David. It's actually inferior. And sometimes if you do that, just by editing the lines, they start to sound more like themselves. And the beautiful thing is that, generally speaking, a person who hits that, you know, that place where they sound like themselves recognizes it and kind of rejoices in it. And then you sort of, you know, your work is kind of done.
And so do you think in terms of identifying your voice, it's just a matter of keeping on writing and just writing and writing and writing until it, you know, it becomes clearer?
I think so. But also I think the role of cutting is really underestimated. You know, I think I get more of my voice such as it is by cutting things out. Actually, it's, you know, we often think it's, so I'm just going to finally inhabit my true self and sing at the top of my lungs with no inhibition. But my thing is more, you do that and then you go, ugh, that sounds like everybody else. And then you start cutting it back. And that's interesting because why, you know, what's the basis for cutting? You know, like there's an exercise in the book where I ask people to take a piece of writing that I did and cut it back, like radically. And the thing is, when you choose to cut something, that's every bit as strong an aesthetic position as when you put something in. And often it's maybe even more, because we all kind of know what a normal sentence sounds like, an habitual kind of almost lazy sentence. The difference between that and a style inflected sentence is those, that micro choosing that a person can learn to do, that which really tells us everything about her, you know.
Yeah.
It's like an anti writing block formula to say, just write down any old crap, really. And if you have a powerful vision, a powerful ear, you can prune away at that mediocre thing until it starts to sound a little strange and good, you know.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about editing, because you explain in the book that you, and I think you mentioned it earlier, that you like to redraft a lot. So you write something and then you keep on redrafting it and redrafting it. And you talk about the role of intuition. Would you just expand a little bit on that and how it works for you?
Yeah, and I would underscore for me, because I think I'm a little excessive about in this approach, but for me the thing is the whole editing process is you approach the text as if you hadn't seen it before. Now that in itself might be about 80% of the job, is learning to do that in a convincing way. So you're not attached to what you did yesterday or your thematic ideas. You're just reading it as if you picked up the book on a bus or something. Then you're just kind of watching your mind to see You know, is your mind leaning into it with pleasure or pulling back in revulsion? And then over the course of your career, I think you can get better at doing that on a really fine level. You know, a slight aversion, you can feel a slight attraction. And then, you know, there's a moment where you know, the thinking mind wants to get involved. You know, it's up there going, it's about patriarchy. But what you really want to do is just turn that down and see, just kind of be directly keyed into the pleasure or whatever you want to call that. And then your hand will make cuts. You know, your hand will say, that phrase is slightly repetitive, and you cut it. Or just literally blurt out a phrase that's interesting, you know. Your mind is interacting with the text in a really intimate way. And so for me, the whole thing is to dial back that conceptual, controlling, lecturing part of my mind that knows what my story is about. Let this other mysterious voice dominate. And what I found over the years is that mysterious voice is really smart. And it knows all about character development and theme and plot and politics, but it just doesn't wear it on its shoulder. You know, so for me, the whole thing has been more, I would say, more meditative than intellectual, in the sense that you're trying to get in touch with the part of yourself that is pretty smart about prose, you know. And then the other thing that works is just to do it over and over again, as you said. It makes me feel a little better about making mistakes. You know, if I screw it up today, I'll fix it tomorrow. And it also somehow, in a way I've never been able to articulate, it gives me access to a better part of myself. Like there's a funnier, more honest part of myself in my prose, especially when it's rewritten like this, than is present if you met me in person. You know, mm-hmm. In person I'm about as funny as your third funniest uncle, and I'm not really that honest. I tend to be a little hyperbolic, and I'm a little Pollyanna-ish. I don't like to say anything negative, you know. So that as a person, that's me. But as a writer, you know, you see a part in your own that's dishonest, that equals a bad sentence usually, or some kind of, you know, strange-looking sentence. You cut it, you fix it, then you're honest, you just went up a notch, and that person is sort of more interesting.
Yeah.
So that's what I've really loved about this job over the years, you know.
Do you ever find yourself stuck and feeling this just isn't working and I can't figure out why? And if you do find yourself in that situation, do you have any kind of tactics to get out of that kind of log jam?
Yes, I find myself in that every day, hopefully, because if you... you know, except at the very end of something, if you don't feel like there's a problem, you're probably not reading it closely enough. You know, in other words, you're reading it, you know how when you read something over and over, it's like a rock that gets smooth. You know, you're not even really reading it like a first-time reader. You're just like, oh, yeah. So I think, yes, there's a piece I'm working on right now that I just hit the end of it. And, you know, it's the worst kind of problem. It's about 80% good, which, you know, it's easy to go, yeah, you know, 80%, pretty good. But I know if I just bear down on it, I can get it up a few more points higher. So I think that for me, the trick at that point is to say, okay, something's wrong with this. And to not say, therefore I'm a loser, you know, or therefore I should quit. Or just to say, yeah, it's not, this story isn't me. It's a product of me, but it's not me. So just like when you see yourself in a home video, you know, do I walk like that? Well, you know, there's walking like that being done, but it doesn't necessarily have to be an indictment. So to say, yeah, there's a problem with this story. And then there's a quick little motion you can make that's so powerful, which is to just very honestly, like you would to a good friend, to say, what's the problem? You know, really, that's okay. You can talk to me. What's going on? And you know, you can say it very bluntly. This part is real, you know, or it doesn't make sense that the dog could drive a car or whatever, you know, whatever it is, it's never anything too intellectual. It's pretty much first order stuff, you know. And you can be really, really blunt in that moment. And once you've turned your mind to the problem, I think you're already kind of close to solving it. One, because you're not despairing anymore. You're not making it about your character, you know. I mean, yourself, your personhood. You're just saying, yeah, this thing I'm making has a technical problem. There aren't an infinite number of solutions. I don't see it right now. That's okay. I'll fix what I can around the edges, maybe tomorrow, you know. But often the problem, when you call it a problem, what you're really saying is that is the ultimate technical virtuosity solution, you know. So, for example, I had a story called Sea Oak, and at the end of the story, there's a woman who's just, I don't want to give it away, but she's had a terrible thing happen to her. The crowning terrible things happened to her in a life of misfortune. And so all the events of the story were done, but it felt somehow unresolved and it needed some kind of ending. And I just thought, kind of in her point of view, wow, why do some people in this everything and other people get nothing? And to her, I went, I don't know. And I thought, that's the ending. You know, that was the problem with the story, is that the story kept saying some people get everything and some people get nothing and didn't offer a solution. And just by directly putting it into the story, that readerly concern got addressed, you know. So I think it's not, if you're writing a story that has no problems, you're not writing a story, you know.
That's comforting. Does that make sense at all? Yeah, it does make sense. I think in some ways this is a negative about the writing life, because you're on your own all the time. And I think sometimes I talk to myself just to hear myself reason it out loud, because there isn't another person there to, like, I don't know, sometimes it's easier to put your finger on these things in discussion with somebody than it is when you're sitting in silence at a desk.
It's true. The only thing I found, though, is that, you know, and actually if you teach a workshop, you see this, that the quality of the discussion, once it gets outside of your head, is inferior to the one you have inside your head. That's the killer. It's always comforting to show somebody else your work. But I think there are certain problems that have to be solved by you, you know, and you're in your story so full-mindedly and full-bodied at some point, you know, after months of working, your subconscious is just, it's like a team of elves up there, you know, just working and working. I have a tendency to not show anybody and have those conversations. But I think the trick is, once you allow that moment of honesty to say, yeah, this story is really messed up, it's like this of that problem is the story. That is what the story is about, actually. You know, the story makes a problem. It's like Houdini, you know. Houdini goes, wow, I'm in trouble. I've got handcuffs and I'm in a shark-infested ocean, you know, and I've got syphilis, whatever. He says all those things. And as soon as he says it, the audience goes, oh, God, that's interesting. How's he going to get out of this one? You know, so you could see that a story is you're really trying to get yourself into that position where this is presented with an insolvable problem, and then you solve it, you know. But the first way to solve it is to go, yeah, I did a good job. You know, I painted myself into a corner.
I wanted to talk to you as well about, there's something else that you say in the book. You talk about having worked with a lot of very talented young writers in your job at Syracuse University. And you say that there are two things that separate those who get published from those who don't. The first is a willingness to revise, which we've just talked about. And the second is the extent to which they've learned to make causality. I thought that was really interesting. Would you just explain a little bit the importance of causality in a story and how that works?
Sure. And I would say first, you know, this, well, I'm going to make a case for causality. And in the same way that I would, if I was talking to a bunch of dancers, I would make a case for gravity. You know, it's just what we have to work against. If I say to you, hey, I've got this incredible story I have to tell you, it's only 8 pages, I think you're going to automatically expect causation. You want A to cause B to cause C. And when you really look at these great stories, that's where the meaning gets made. You know, Scrooge, Scrooge is stingy. We expect from the beginning that he's going to get unstingy. How does that happen? You know, what causes it? And that's where the story's unquote message lies, you know, in the causality. So in a way, it's sort of like we talked about the joke form or a song. Once you know what the form does best, you've kind of signed up for certain responsibilities. So if I say to you, once upon a time, a guy was really happy, and then the next day he was just as happy, and the third day he woke up and he was the same level of happy that he was before. I mean, you understand that this is not a story. So you want the happiness to cause something, you know. So really, I think it's just kind of like it's not a rule, but it's a law. And even in Waiting for Godot, where nothing's causing anything, we feel the weight of the causality. And the story, that play is brilliant because it resists it, but it doesn't mean it denies its existence. You know, so it's kind of Hollywood stuff, you know. A woman sees her old boyfriend in the store. If it doesn't cause anything, that's an anecdote. But if she sees her old boyfriend in the store, goes out to the car, and the baby starts crying, and she begins to doubt her marriage, then suddenly we've got some causation going on, and the story starts to sort of narrow its focus a little bit.
Yeah. And is that related to, you also talk about escalation, that a story needs to escalate. And I guess that this should have been obvious to me, but I hadn't really thought about it in those terms until I read your book. But I guess it's the A causing B causing C, which gives you the sense of escalation.
I think so. And, you know, all these things I think are related. They're kind of one concept. And also, I think, you know, throughout the book, I try to keep saying, unless I'm wrong, you know, like there are some writers who maybe, you know, they think about it in an entirely different, way, and it works for them. So the, you know, in Buddhism, they say that the teachings are the finger pointing at the moon. So you don't want to confuse finger with, what we want to do is write stories that compel people to read them. And everybody, you know, makes up their own litany of aphorisms and advice. But for me, to think about story as an intense system of causation and escalation, it helps me write them, but also it kind of makes sense in terms of the form. You know, there's a sort of de facto urgency in the fact that it's 9 pages long, and I think the form tells, or the length tells us a lot about the form. And you know, if I say, God, Hattie, you're not going to believe what happened this morning. Well, that's a pretty good start to a story, and it's implied in there is that something exciting has happened that's meaningful. And if it isn't exciting and it isn't meaningful, i.e. if it doesn't have causation and escalation, you're going to feel a little let down in the end. Like, why did he tell me that? That's not interesting.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my kind of working class version of it. And what I say to my students is just take as much of this as helps. You know, if this totally turns you off, then just don't sign up, you know. But yeah, that, I think it's all any teacher can do is say, here's the excessive, inexplicable, indefensible set of ideas that have worked for me. If there's any of them that would help you, please help yourself, you know.
Yeah. What is something that you find challenging as a writer?
The biggest thing that's just left in my mind is that, you know, I'm 62 years old, and I have loved being on this planet so much, and I don't feel like I've gotten the full range of that delight in my stories yet. And that's it. You know, I my mind has a beautiful kind of ongoing novel in it that I have not been able to get on the page yet. And partly it's fear, as we talked about earlier. It's also, you know, like if a person is lucky enough to get published, it's a little bit like getting asked a really nice party. You know, you come into the party like, wow, I'm so glad this person invited me. You're kind of, you have a maybe overzealous attachment to the person who invited you. So if like me, you got into publication by being, you know, funny and edgy and sci-fi, let's say, you know, then it takes a little bit of guts to move away from those things and try to expand your approach. You know, it's because you run the risk of losing all your power by giving up on the stuff that you've been nurturing in yourself. So at this point in my life, it's kind of like my vision of the world is bigger and more generous and more celebratory than my writing is. And it feels like kind of a mad dash to try to expand my writing so that it would present, you know, some fraction of that joyfulness in the actual prose.
That's great to feel that way, though. That's a kind of exciting rocket fuel.
It is. And it's, you know, especially, I mean, you know, I mean, God willing, I'll live another 80 years, but the, to have passed 60 and go, wow, so this shit really ends, you know, I mean, not just for you, but for me, it's remarkable, you know, and it really makes, it puts you in a beautiful connection with the writers who have gone before, you know, and I think, you know, more and more, I'm just like, I just want to give somebody down the line some idea of how much beauty I found here, you know, complicated beauty and ugliness and all that. But so it's a nice place to be and to have a little bit of time to do it and to feel like I've, you know, you've built up some skills that might help. It's very, very rich, you know.
I, for what it's worth, I think that that view of the world comes through in Lincoln in the Bardo, which is a very, you know, it's a very sad subject matter about death, but it also says a lot about the beauty of the world, I think, and about hope and love. And so I don't think you failed to put that across, but
Well, that was an interesting one because that required a real leaving. I had to leave at the door a lot of the stuff that I've been using so far. And that was fun, you know, to say, yeah, well, maybe I'm not just, as you said earlier, I'm not just what I've written, but I'm also more, you know, I can drop my usual gifts and might still have some other ones. So that was a fun kind of late life adventure.
And could you think of an example of something that you have learned in your writing life that improved your writing? Like, was there any light bulb moment looking back where you thought, oh yeah, that's how I should be doing that?
Well, one thing I'm trying to think, I've told the story before, but one thing that happened to me is really a light bulb moment was I had been working away at these imitations of, you know, by turns, Hemingway and Joyce and sometimes Malcolm Lowry and whoever, Kerouac. And then I was at my work. I was a tech writer, and I was on a conference call doing a transcription. So I got bored, and I just started writing these little kind of naughty doggerel type Dr. Seussian poems. And then I would just make a little drawing in the margin. And I did that for the whole, you know, for the whole conference call. Brought them home, and my wife read them, and she really liked them. She laughed out loud, and I got a kind of a reaction from her that I hadn't gotten from anybody reading my work in a long time. That was a big light bulb moment because, one, when I was writing those, I wasn't trying to do anything. I literally, my mind was not on them. I was listening to the conference call, and I was just, you know, farting around. But there was more power in that than there had been in all this deliberate, concept-laden stuff I've been working on. And if there was anything my mind was trying to do, it was just trying to amuse myself, trying to be funny. So that was a big, you know, so the moment was, the first state is, I know what I want to say, dear reader, shut up, and just sit there and take it. You know, I'm going to pull up this dump truck full of my ideas and drop them on you because I'm so smart and well-traveled, you know. The second mode was, I love you, dear reader, and I want us to be in an intimate conversation for which, yes, you admire me, but also you're going to have so much fun, and I'm going to do everything I can to keep you listening to me, and I'm going to respect you. That was a switch that happened the minute I heard my wife laughing. Oh, yeah, of course. I have not been thinking of the reader at all, yeah. And I certainly haven't been thinking of her as a three-dimensional, interesting person. So that's something that when I get lost now, I go back to that mode, like, oh, yeah, there's a person out there who's been nice enough to pick up your book. Can you offer her anything in the same way that you would offer a friend across the table, a conversation, you know?
And looking back on your writing life, what do you feel proudest of?
My first thought was to say Lincoln and the Bardo. That was a really, mainly just because it was, it really got me out of my box, the box I'd constructed from the previous 15 years of publishing. But you know, the answer, we talked earlier about self-gaming. And so for me, when I get a question like that, I kind of want to go, nothing. You know, yeah, I just want to say, nothing has pleased me yet. Not because it's true, but because it helps me, you know, to say, yeah, I made some mistakes. You know, I wrote some books. I did the best I could. I hope they're good. But meanwhile, off to the races, don't worry about those. And so what I find is if I start to allow myself to take pride in something or to be ashamed of something, it solidifies my path a little too much. Whereas if I just say, oh, I've been goofing around until now, none of that counts, then, you know, I feel better.
That was George Saunders, and a huge thank you to him for that chat. I highly recommend that you read as many of George's books as you can. I've added his new one, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, plus Lincoln in the Bardo, and some of his short story collections to my shop on bookshop.org. You can also find books by other guests of the podcast there. It's at uk.bookshop.org/shop/in-writing, which I will put in the show notes as well. Or you can just go to bookshop.org and search for my name, and it should come up under shops. I get 10% commission on those sales, so by purchasing from the shop, you help me to keep making the podcast. But more importantly, 10% goes into a pool which is distributed between independent booksellers. Thanks again to my sponsor, Curtis Brown Creative. If you're interested in doing your own creative writing, start your story today with a Curtis Brown Creative online course. Use the code INWRITING20, that's 20, for £20 off one of their 4, 6 or 10 week online courses. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate and review it to help me attract more listeners like you. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.